Thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. This is Like It Is. Today, Sonny Buxton is my guest. Sonny is a legendary jazz performer, club owner, former professional football player with the Oakland Raiders, and presently host of his weekly Saturday morning radio show on KCSM in San Mateo, California.
What keeps you and those who love jazz and those who love producing musical content? Is it a new experience each time you come to the studio and sit in your particular control seat and present the music? Is it a new experience each time you do it, or do you feel any degree of excitement when you come in each Saturday?
I have both. It is a new experience because I'm still searching for that show that just knocks me out. I'll probably never arrive at that one. But and then the other part of it is that it's challenging to put all this stuff together. I sometimes I imagine myself having an assignment of a 60-minute show. Years ago, that's what I had. One of my first shows was just an hour long. So how do you put one of those things together and make it work? First of all, you have to have shorter tracks, and you have to have some sort of a message and some theme, a heavy theme that you're trying to present and also accomplish putting that together for 1 hour. But in 4 hours, it's pretty much the same thing. I think the thing has to be balanced. And so sometimes I'm reflecting upon the years that I spent owning nightclubs, operating nightclubs, because that was my contribution over the years. And once I really stopped playing, I said, well, I'm gonna keep my hand in it. So that means making a financial investment, because if you're gonna go into jazz clubs, you're most likely gonna you're gonna go broke. So that's just the way it is. So I think about that sometimes as I'm playing, and I will try to insert little pieces, little tidbits of inside information about some of the artists that I presented over the years. And so some of them are still left, and a lot of them are gone. In fact, the majority of them are gone now.
I think this is a good transition point to your club ownership experience, and in particular, Jazz at Pearls. But I want you to talk about your other clubs, and then we'll save Pearl as the third point when you're sharing your reflection. Sure. I want you to paint a beautiful picture of what went on at those clubs, please.
My first venture as an owner was part owner with two other guys. We opened a place, it's a jazz coffee house that opened in Seattle. I had experienced that in some part in Los Angeles and also here in the Bay Area. And that looked like a successful operation. It was not so in Seattle. But the three of us opened this place. And so the idea was to take the artists that were appearing at this place called the Penthouse, which is a full-time jazz club, and pretty sophisticated. And this guy had allowed me to start booking certain shows for him, and we'd come up with a fee arrangement and so on. So when I opened the Red Rooster, which was a famous name, by the way, in Harlem earlier time period, we would take the same heavyweight act, and we would take it for one show, but we didn't start until midnight with that act. Sometimes I'd take 11 o'clock and then 12 o'clock. So the act that just about put us out of business was Lambert, Hendrix, and Bavon. And that was John Hendrix and Dave Lambert and Yolande Bavon. And then she replaced Annie Ross. Anyway, that was expensive. There was a rhythm section plus the frontliners. And here we were trying to sell juices, coffees, and sweet rolls and things like that. And I always say jokingly that I think we probably set some kind of a record, because just shy of 6 months, we were out of business. Mm-hmm. So it was that way. So that was a tough lesson. And also I was embarrassed, because I thought I was a pretty smart guy. And I knew something about it. I'd been observing these club operations for a while. So I thought, well, I have to get back into the business just to square things with Sonny. I didn't have to square up with anybody else, but I had to square up with myself because I thought that I knew better. So about, I guess, 2 years later, a guy approached me and he said, you know that place called the Tiki Tavern? I said, oh, yeah. He says, man, he said, pretty bad place. I said, yeah. I said, somebody gets caught in there every weekend. So he said, well, he said, I'm thinking about taking that place over. I said, for what? I said, I hope you're not talking to me about going in there. He said, yeah, I am. I said, oh, no, man. So the guy kept coming around. He was really persistent. You know, he said, look, I got this idea. I'm going to tell you how way out this place was. Some guy had a fight in there one night. And so the guy, one of the guys who had been in the fight goes out, gets his car, comes back with his car, drives his car into the front entrance to this place. So that's the kind of joint the Tiki Tavern was. And so this guy kept talking and talking, and then I said, oh, man. So I'm still talking to myself about my early experience with this Red Rooster. And so I thought, oh, man, come on. You keep telling yourself that you're smart and you know the angles and everything, and this guy's talking to you about this joint, you know. So he came back with one day with some plans, and he said they have these plans, and he said they can you can augment these plans, you can put some other stuff in. He said come on, he said, I think that neighborhood's changing. And I said let me start investigating the neighborhood more. Well, at the same time, I was by this time the radio station that I'd started with it is on the air, and we're moving along fairly well. So I have been doing a lot of neighborhood research anyway. I would say community development is probably better handled. I said, this may fall right in there. So I started going around just at various businesses, and I talked with them, and they all wanted that place to never reopen. That neighborhood was changing rapidly, and they did not want another Tiki Tavern there. And so I would ask people, I said, well, so what do you think should happen? Some people said, tear the whole building down, tear it down. Others were saying, well, why does it have to be that kind of a joint, you know? So I got back to this fellow, Jim, what was his name? And I said, Jim, here's what I discovered. And he said, we can do that. We can do it. I said, yeah. So now I said, look, what kind of money are we talking? What kind of money do I have to come up with? So he gave me some figures. And I said, I can't come up with that much money. So then I was talking with another old friend of mine who had just recently moved back to Seattle from Los Angeles. And I told him about this idea that I had. And he jumped right in. He said, yeah. He said, that whole area is changing. And he said, changing overnight. He said, man, he said, we could do that. And I said, you really think so? I said, so what about the other thing? I said, we have a construction cost. And I said, it's going to be pretty steep. He said, well, why don't we go in there? He said, we can go in there. We can do a lot of the work, and we can hire some people to do the stuff that we can't handle. So to make a long story short, we did it. And we opened the place, and it took some time. And it's kind of funny. We worked there at night. I mean, late at night, we're in there hammering, and the stage is going to be over here, and the bar over there, and so blah, blah, blah. And friends would stop by. We'd have the lights on at night. So, Sonny, tell me, where's that bar going to be? And I tell them, and they say, ah, they'd laugh. I said, you guys are crazy. This is not going to happen. So we opened. It took some time to get the place open. And I had a contract with the Monterey Jazz Festival to do some film work. And I left one night. And we opened with a lot of fanfare. And then the place kind of leveled off, and we weren't doing much business at all. And I thought, man, I can't believe that I failed in the first two ventures of this club stuff. And I took off to come back down here to do this work with Jimmy Lyons and the Monterey Festival. So I called my partner, and I said, well, how did it go last night? And which was a Friday night. He said, yeah. He said, you know, funny thing happened. He said, we had people lined up to get in. I said, lined up? I said, what? He said, well, I asked him, I said, well, what was it? He said, I don't know what that was about. So I said, okay. I said, well, contact me. I met this hotel and so on. So the following night, or actually 2 days, 2 days later, he called me. He said, you know, he said, last night we had the same thing. People were lined up. He said, they were lined up for a quarter of a block to get in. I said, who were they? And he said, well, he said, they're mostly a white audience. I said, is that right? I said, how could that be? So from that point on, to make a long story short, we had people lined up every night to get in the place. And what had triggered it the first time around is that a sorority at the University of Washington had voted for me as the disc jockey of the year. And it's an annual thing that they would do. And you go out and have dinner with the sorority sisters and so on. And have an evening, you know, at the fireplace and drink eggnog or some grog and so on. So I invited all of them to the club. I told them about the club. So we had a night for them, for that sorority, which was great for a lot of people. And we invited some inside friends to come over and join us. So I think that they passed the word that there was an interesting place. It was a jazz place. And it was not in the heart of the Black community, but it was on the fringe. We never turned around in that place. I mean, it was full every night. I mean, six nights a week, that place was full. And then, so that was a launching pad. And we went from that to another large place that we called the District, which was much closer to the University of Washington. And we had a mixed bag of music in there. We had jazz and we had R&B bands, but with a jazz tinge. So there was always that element of jazz. This is a large place. And we seated 400 people in that place, and we could cordon it off. And I was always a filmmaker, so I'd have film nights in there, and we had a game room, and that was very successful. Then we opened a small place called the Anxious Ass, and that was all jazz tape, and it was a very successful place. We only seated about. Maybe 70 people in there. So we went bar, and we had throw pillows and a little balcony upstairs, and people loved to hang out there. And the music was always I sort of curated that music for that place. It's just based upon the people that I saw coming in, and so a lot of people fell in love with it, even those who were not jazz fans. So that was the beginning of that, and then later I. I opened a place in San Francisco called Milestones. But before that, I was out of the business, and I'd gone into television and radio, and I was always working both ends, TV and radio, and the TV thing was very demanding, and so but I had got a chance to go to New York to work television, so I had to do that, and as a newsman. But I always had this thing in the back of my mind that at some point I was going to open a jazz night spot in San Francisco. And so I finally had a chance to do that. And that was, when was it, 1984. So I decided to poured some money into it. And I got my cousin as a partner and another guy who underwrote some of us because we had to come up with more than that. It's about $1,250,000 really to get this thing going. So, and that was a tidy sum of money, but it was something that was a dream. I had just the right architect and interior decorators to get this place going. Acoustically, it was beautiful, really sound. And so we opened with Joe Henderson, great tenor saxophonist. And so from that point on, That place did well. And then we stumbled, and it became expensive and more expensive to operate because trying to get musicians in from New York was expensive because you have a transportation fee plus hotel accommodations. And so then the earthquake came along. So I always say that that gave me a perfect excuse to get out.
Touche. Yeah, right.
If you are away from your favorite radio station, you can find Like It Is on NV1 app for Apple and Android. My guest is Sonny Buxton. We return to that interview right now.
So Pearl Wong was a lady who was just recently introduced to jazz. This was a Chinese lady. She and her daughter were remotely interested in jazz, but they didn't know that much about it. But I had met the two of them. And so when my place was knocked out with the earthquake, Pearl was a middle-aged Chinese lady, as I said. And she was interested in continuing with this jazz thing, but she didn't really know that much about it. She just knew that she liked jazz singers. She liked that, but the other intricate part of it, she was not knowledgeable. She said, "I'd like to open a place," and she wanted to know if I would help her. And I wasn't sure that I really wanted to do this again. I said, I've almost run the gamut with these jazz places. And also I'd managed a couple of other places too. And so I've had a lot of that. So anyway, I began to think about this, and I said, you're two Chinese ladies, mother and daughter, who are really interested in opening a jazz night spot. I said, that's pretty way out. So I told Pearl, I said, I'll work along with you. I said, let me just see how all this falls. If it falls into place, and then maybe I'll come along. So it did. It took about a year and a half. And so Jazz of Pearls opened, and that was right in the heart of North Beach. And we got that place going, and it became like the place for musicians to hang out. I know many different days people would drop checks off if they had hotel gigs, and the payday was only every other week or something. So they dropped the check off at Pearls because everybody came in there. And so down in the office, I'd have checks pinned to a bulletin board. And so somebody said, "Yeah, man, it was my check." I said, "Yeah, it's here." So I had to go downstairs and pick up the check. And it was a place where if you wanted to meet people, I remember one night it was really slow, and the party of people came in, and they, I said, "Oh, anybody coming in?" I said, "No, it's late. We're not likely to have any more people." And they said, "Well, who's playing?" And I said, "Do you recognize that piano player?" And then they said, "No." I said, "That's Harry Connick." And they said, "No, it isn't." I said, "Yeah, that's Harry Connick." And Harry Connick was in town with his orchestra and doing a show. And so some of his band members had been coming to the club just to sit in on various nights. And so he came by to play, and he's a pretty good piano player. But we had Tony Bennett come. He didn't perform, but he came and sketched everybody in the band. And Tony came there twice and stayed for long periods of time. He loved the place. And it was that way. Mel Brooks and his wife were there, and so we have some nice photos of him. And so it was that kind of experience. And it was a long one. We did 13 years in that place. And so we bowed out when the landlord refused to give us any more than a 5-year lease. So as I told Pearl, I said, I don't want to die in this joint. So it's time to get out. So anyway, it was a long haul. And so that was a total of 18 years, really, that I had straight years with the Milestones, and then going straight from that to Jazz of Pearls. And so 18 years is a pretty healthy slice out of my life.
Well, I want to talk about, as we move toward the end of this fascinating interview, retrospective, I'll call it. It's been so informative and interesting for me to be in your presence via this interview. I think one of the things that being a sports fanatic, in particular, a legendary, I underscore that, fan of the Oakland Raiders, and you played with the Oakland Raiders, and I feel privileged to have the opportunity to ask you, how was it, and tell me a bit about your experience as a Raider.
That almost happened by accident. when I was in the military, I played the ball. I didn't go on there to play, although there were other associates that I had in the military that were there just to play ball. But I was on my way back to the United States, and I was in London I worked as a team in this outfit that I was in. And we were waiting for an assignment, and we were housed in a hotel in London. And mind you, I was still in the military. Excuse me. And one day, major came to the hotel room, and he had a full dossier on me, and he identified himself as being the assistant head coach of this football team in Wiesbaden, Germany. And the two of us, my partner and I, were staying in the hotel room. We're military people now. And I'm listening to this guy and looking at him, and I said, well, what the hell is he talking about? I knew that we were waiting for an assignment, and it wasn't that. So he said, you know, finally he got around to the truth of the matter. He said, you know, last year, we almost won the championship for this whole, what they call district or something like that. And they said, this year we're going to win it. Well, one thing I didn't know about the teams in the military at that time is that they put a lot of money into those games, officers in particular. And boy, and they had a large pool that they would put together for championship games and individual games and so on. So they would start recruiting players. So this guy had, as I said, had this dossier on me, and he said, you're a running back and you're this and blah, blah, blah. And he said, we could use you. And we lost the guy to the attrition, military attrition. And I said, look, I said, I'm waiting for another assignment. I said, I think I'm going to California. And I said, I'm from that area. So I said, I don't want to mess around and not get there. He said, we can fix that up. So they did. I went to Wiesbaden to play football. And so I'm still in the military. And so we tied for the championship, we didn't win it. But while I was there, that's all I did. I was there with this whole group of other guys. And so we played ball. And then during the day, we had some pretty loose assignments, maybe cleaning up the area where we slept and that sort of thing. And we'd work out in the gym. And that was the assignment. So when I did get the California assignment. So when I got back here, one of the coaches made contact with me while I was reassigned to California. He said, you know, they're going to start this new league, the American Football League. And he said, you should think about that. And I wasn't really thinking about it. And he says, yeah, you could get it. You could play that. So I decided to give it a shot. I said, you know, might be fun for a couple of years. And I was watching how they were assembling this American Football League and where they were going to station teams and so on. So as it turned out, I was a little too small to be running back for what they were thinking about. And I was about 205 pounds, and that was not going to work. So I played linebacker before all this came down. So one guy said, you know, how about defensive back? I said, I never played defensive back. He said, well, you could. So they sent me to, by this time, I got this little contract, and it was pretty small. So I went back to Pennsylvania, and just outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Pittsburgh. And they had a league back there called the Continental Football League. So I played there, and I did fairly well. But a couple of things happened that were funny. The first thing that I had never been in a locker room where people were smoking. So I'm in this locker room back there in the Continental Football League. Guys are smoking, drinking beer, and we played on Friday night. And Friday night back there in those that industrial area, man, I mean, this is like gladiator time. that's the way the people looked at it back there. I couldn't wait to get out of there. So fortunately, I got hurt and got out of there. I was I intercepted a pass, and it's kind of a funny story. The guy on the opposing team said, "Look out! Look out!" You know, and I'm doing my little dance. You know, I intercepted this ball, and I ran into the goalpost. Out cold. So I was sent back to California, and I guess somebody out here was injured, I think, and so they decided to put me in. So I played this. So I did 5 seasons, which was more than enough. And my head was it was there, but it was also on developing my career, getting my life going. And mind you, in those early years of the American Football League, the pay wasn't that heavy. It wasn't light, but it wasn't heavy. And just about everybody worked summer jobs in order to augment what they were earning. And also, comparing those years to today, and not just salary. I mean, there's no way of comparing salaries. But you had to renegotiate each year, each new season. So if we had a couple of guys that played straight through, wouldn't take any time off for injuries, and then that was sort of typical. Was when you sat down to negotiate your upcoming year, you were not allowed to come in with an attorney or an agent. You just sort of sitting there on your own, and I sort of picked up on that early on. And I remember one guy saying that he had been seriously hurt. He hurt his knee and his shoulder, and he said they were picking him apart. He says, "Well, yeah, you missed a game and a half." They said, "Well, coach had a broken leg, and that doesn't matter." I said, "Well, I'm going to get out of here." So I finally had a kind of a showdown with Al Davis, who became the famous leader of the Oakland Raiders for a number of years, and coach and owner. But when he was a coach, I would, as I said, I was beginning to think about my life and career. So if you had a training session, we didn't have a bunch of trainers at the time. You'd have an appointment, and you'd have to wait frequently in the locker room area to have your session with a trainer. And I was waiting. So I would read different books, and I was reading more about broadcasting and things of that nature, primarily broadcasting.
Well, I can tell you, Sonny, we are so proud and so blessed to have you hosting at KCSM Saturdays 10 to 2 p.m. That's Pacific time on KCSM 91.1, streaming live on kcsm.org. It's been my honor and privilege to have shared these moments with you. Thank you so much, Sonny.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Robert.
If you find yourself away from your favorite radio station, you can find this episode of Like It Is and many others on your favorite podcast app. I want to thank listeners who have kept Like It Is on air for 30 years. I'm here for you, and I want to hear from you. Send me a message on www.greenthumbfoundationinc.com. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.